Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today, we've invited NPR host Steve Inskeep onto our show to talk about his recent trip to Appalachia. We'll hear from former coal miner from Whitesburg, Kentucky, Gary Bentley.
You grow up in this area, and the coal miners are the ones who were able to provide their families with things that not everybody else could have. And it's, you know, the idea that these people go to work every day knowing that they may not make it back home alive, in order to provide for their families and make a better life.
And we'll hear from Ralph Slaughter, a veteran who lives in Bristol, Virginia.
We traded in $10, $12, $15 an hour jobs for $7, $8 jobs. Go up and down any street you want to choose and look at how many houses for sale and how many apartments are for rent. The whole damn place is selling out.
We're taking a road trip to find out what's important to voters this week on Inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. This year, America will elect a new president. Some folks are counting down the days until President Obama is out of office, while others shiver at the thought of the possibilities we have in a new president. So what's on the minds of Appalachians? Well, understanding what motivates voters anywhere to support one candidate over another isn't always as simple as party affiliation or even surveys. While there's always room to find common ground between groups of people if you look for it, there are many unique struggles and challenges that create a different set of priorities for many of us Appalachians. On this show, we're going on a road trip through Appalachia to find out what's important to voters. You might be familiar with the series called The View From. It's part of the political coverage for NPR show Morning Edition. The crew from the show recently traveled to Appalachia to get the view from parts of the mountains. And we've invited Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep onto our show to talk about the visit. Hi, Steve.
Hey, glad to be here.
So what drew you to Appalachia, and why visit the region now?
Well, the reason for NPR to be there was that we were looking at different regions. You know, the view from here, what do national issues look on a local or regional level? Because it can be different, and people have different perspectives based on where they're living and what the economy is like where they are and what the industries are and what the landscape is like. Mm-hmm. And we're going to different parts of the country. David Green, my colleague, has been in Peoria, Illinois, been out to Montana. And the first one that I chose to do was the region of Appalachia because it is really close to my life and close to my heart. And also, I think, a really important story for the country to understand.
What did you find was different and unique with the view from Appalachia from some of the other views?
Well, the first thing is to think about the landscape. It is so distinct in Appalachia. It is defined, of course, by the mountains, and they're a particular kind of mountains. As a musician pointed out during the program, they're very old. They're worn down like old teeth, he said, and that makes you think about time in a different way. And that landscape has also affected economic opportunity. If you go through some of the great valleys of the Appalachian region along Interstate 81, it's a little more open and a little flatter, but still pretty with mountains on the horizon. But there's space and there's access and there's transit and there's economic growth. You get up into some of the steeper mountains, and it's more of a challenge in many areas, as you know far better than I. And there are regions where the economy has been based on resource extraction. First it was timber, then it was coal. Now the industry is changing in ways that very few people are working in coal, and there's a terrible struggle to figure out what people can do.
And it is very different. There's lots of different, I think, perceptions and different views, even within the Appalachian region. A lot of times we talk on our show about my Appalachia is different from your Appalachia, from people who are here. And that's okay, you know, because we all have different stories. Some of the recent stories that appeared on the series that you did as part of this recent visit to Appalachia were about coal mining, healthcare, the economy, like you mentioned, a little bit of broadband access, tied into politics, basically. Why was Appalachia a place to tell these stories?
Oh, well, I mean, in some sense, you could pick anywhere on the map and find some of these stories. But there's a special nature of those stories in the Appalachian region. You mentioned broadband, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's interested in having pretty good internet. But it turns out that there are several states that are at least partially Appalachian states that are having this big debate because there are rural areas that don't have good internet. And people in rural areas are saying to themselves, I think very astutely, with the internet, people can live anywhere. And if we get some entrepreneurs to locate in our town because it's pretty, because it's a nice place to live, we can really boost the local economy and we can take places that have been losing population and they could gain a little. But you need a good broadband connection or people just aren't going to put their business there. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, how do you do that? The state of Tennessee has had a big debate over this. The city of Chattanooga decided to make itself known as a place with great, fast internet. And the city itself did that job and installed better internet broadband across the city, took the responsibility for that. But the state government didn't like that, mm-hmm. considered that to be government competition with private businesses. And they've actually banned other cities from doing the same thing, except that private companies haven't necessarily been into every little holler to get the kind of good internet that you might like to have. There's a similar debate in North Carolina. There's a variant on this debate in the state of Kentucky. This is a big deal in rural areas especially, and it's really fascinating.
There's also been a similar debate here in West Virginia as well.
There you go.
So were there any unique challenges for you and the Morning Edition crew that you had to overcome, such as maybe broadband access, in order to bring the show to this part of Appalachia?
You know, the cell reception is maybe not what you would like as you're driving around. We flew into Johnson City, Tennessee. We drove across that far western point of Virginia interviewing people as we went. We went into Whitesburg, Kentucky, Letcher County, Kentucky, and then back down to Knoxville, which is where we broadcast from. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there are any particular challenges. It's a region that I really love and that I learned a lot about when I was going to Morehead State University, although many parts of it were new to me. I'd never been to Whitesburg, for example. It's a fascinating, fascinating city with fascinating people. And I think the major challenge is just to understand what you're looking at and to make sure that you're listening to people's real stories. Now, this is really tricky, and I bet you're familiar with this challenge.
Mm-hmm.
We're reporting on an area that has, for example, an awful lot of poverty. And you don't want to stereotype people as a certain kind of poor person, but you do, as a journalist, want to report on that issue and what it means to people. And so I think it's especially important to make sure that you're listening to the particulars of someone's story.
Mm-hmm. We do talk a lot about stereotypes and how to tell who's telling Appalachia's story and things like that on this show a lot. You also visited Western Kentucky back in January.
Yeah.
And where the coal industry there is doing a little bit better than it is in Letcher County, Kentucky,
Not totally dead, yes. It's not dead.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what were your thoughts about how the western part of the state is different from the Appalachian part of Kentucky? Did you notice anything different between, I mean, just regionally, western versus eastern?
Well, there were a lot of similarities. Some differences, mm-hmm. too. It's just more open countryside. It's flatter. It's a little more like my home state of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Culturally, the experience seemed quite similar to me. When you talk with coal miners in Western Kentucky, many of whom are now ex-coal miners, or when you talk with the coal miners in Eastern Kentucky, who are almost all ex-coal miners in Letcher County at this point,
mm-hmm.
you find out that it's something that people have done for generations. People did that job because their father did that job, and because his father did that job, because his father did that job. You understand why it is that people feel that industry as part of their identity, even though we're at a point now where not very many people work in it anymore. And really, it's been true because of mechanization. For decades, not very many people really have worked in the coal industry in any eastern state. But it is part of people's heritage, and you understand how challenging it is. Something else that's really similar is just that this is really hard work. And I'm not telling you anything that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we were saying something that a lot of Americans don't quite grasp. You go into a coal mine And some of them are rather large, relatively high ceilings. I was in one in Western Kentucky that had, I think, about a 9-foot high ceiling. But it's way more typical to have a coal mine with a ceiling that's 5 feet high or 3.5 feet high or less than that.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about spending hours and hours each day in an environment where you can't even stand up, where you can barely even sit up, where you're constantly scratching your back on the roof of the tunnel that you're in, and where you are hundreds of feet underground, you begin to get a picture of the difficulty of that life, the strain of that life, and also the power of the stories that are built up around it.
Mm-hmm. And much of that coal that's left these days, I mean, they say that a lot of the coal, the easy coal, so to speak, has been mined out. So now they have what's left that they call low coal, which is really shallow seams, I guess I could say. So now that you visited this region recently and came back, do you think there will be any continuing coverage of this region? Do you think that the region and its people need more national coverage?
Oh, goodness. I hope that we do. And it's not a subject that's terribly new to me. The first story that I can recall doing on NPR that related directly to Appalachia was in Thurmond, West Virginia.
Yeah.
In the 1990s, on All Things Considered, I did a 13-minute long story about this town with 11 people. I believe we counted them at the time, and we believed there to be 7 people in Thurmond and about 4 more in the suburbs, so to speak. And I got to talk to most of them in the course of a day or two of reporting. And you probably know the story of Thurmond. I mean, it's this amazing historic site that was a very busy, not precisely a coal camp, but near coal camps. And it was a banking center and a business center built on the side of a mountain in New River Gorge. And and now hardly any people were living there when I went there. And the National Park Service was trying to kind of coax people out so they could just turn it into a pretty little historic site.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a lovely story. And I've come back ever since, whenever I get a chance. My wife is from another part of Appalachia. She's from upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you travel through Pittsburgh and you realize you're in yet another part of Appalachia, or you're going to Wheeling, West Virginia, and across the river into southern Ohio to interview voters in a swing state, and you're in Appalachia. This landscape is on my mind. In fact, I wrote a book. It's about Andrew Jackson and the Cherokees, and it's set in the Southern Appalachians. This is a continuing theme in my work. It's a continuing theme for public media, and it ought to be. First, because the stories are really interesting. Second, because they're really important. And third, because Appalachia has such a great part of the American story and the American identity, which I think some people don't even realize that when they talk about the American story, they're quite often talking about some little part of Appalachia.
Now we're going to listen to Steve's stories from his trip through Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
And I'm Steve Inskeep with The View from Appalachia, exploring how national issues look from a local level. We're in Knoxville, Tennessee, where people say Appalachia, not Appalachia. We're before a live audience at Holly's Gourmet's Kitchen and joined by some of our friends from NPR's Generation Listen and WUOT in Knoxville. Anybody listen to that station here? We are in a region shaped by generations of migration. Now, a new wave of economic migrants is leaving and sometimes coming back. For example, Gary Bentley, who met us at a coal mine where he used to work in tunnels, sometimes just 36 inches high.
How do you work in a tunnel that's only 3 feet high?
Crawling on your hands and knees for 12 hours. It can be intense.
That doesn't sound like any fun.
No, it's not fun, but when it's the only thing you know, you become accustomed to it, and it's another day at work.
Dangerous work that cost his grandfather his arm. Yet Bentley says the pay of $70,000 per year was like an addiction.
You grow up in this area, and the coal miners are the ones who were able to provide their families with things that not everybody else could have. And it's, you know, the idea that these people go to work every day knowing that they may not make it back home alive in order to provide for their families and make a better life. So there's something about that just kind of tugs at you.
Bentley lost his job as the coal market collapsed a few years ago. Letcher County, Kentucky, once had thousands of coal jobs. It now has 100.
Bentley had to move to the far side of his state. Because he's divorced, he had to leave his daughter.
Can we just mention, this is a long state. You were hundreds of miles from your daughter.
Yes, I think 384 miles, exactly.
Not that anybody was counting.
Yeah, it was a six-hour trip, roughly. So it was a struggle.
Now this former coal miner lives in Lexington, Kentucky, and works in a Dixie Cup factory. Other people want out of Letcher County. We found Shauna Gabrielle Coots working and studying at a community college. She is 20 and a single mom.
My baby daddy wasn't someone I thought he was, and it didn't work out. And he never comes around. So I'm doing everything on my own. I can do it. That's why I want to go into the military.
After the military, she wants to be a state trooper, but not in her home county where drug abuse is a problem.
If I be a cop here, then I'll probably be arresting some of my friends, honestly. And a lot of my friends has gone downhill, and it would kind of suck if I put, like, one of my used-to-be-close friends in the back of a cop car. So that's why I want to go away and be a cop. It's like every day you see on the news, like, people's getting busted for meth, and I don't want to be around here no more.
Migration made Appalachia what it is today. European settlers pushed into these hills seeking a better life. After World War II, many of their descendants departed for Midwestern factories. In recent years, Letcher County, Kentucky has lost another 5% of its population. Yet something happens to many migrants. It happened to Shauna K. Rodenberg after she went to college and got out. Something drew her back.
I love it here. There's nowhere else that I really feel like myself. In Letcher County, I don't feel like I have to have any kind of artifice, pretend to be something that I'm not.
She now commutes to Eastern Kentucky, driving hundreds of miles once a week to teach English at a community college. In a Whitesburg, Kentucky restaurant, we talked with two Letcher County natives who returned full-time. Elizabeth Sanders and Brad Shepard each made choices to try their fortunes.
I was really clear with myself when I came back that, you know, my parents really felt like they needed to move away for certain opportunities, and I wanted to figure out for myself how I can be here and raise a family here, and hopefully that'll happen.
Growing up, you don't know what you want to do. It just doesn't seem like the place. There's no opportunity unless you wanted to work in the coal mines. So I was like, well, I'm getting out of here where there's nothing to do. But you just keep wanting to come home.
So here they are. Elizabeth Sanders works for Apple Shop, a media organization. Brad Shepard and his husband opened Heritage Kitchen, the restaurant where we sat. It's trendy with the waitress wearing black on a surprisingly vibrant Main Street. Granted, it's not always easy to do business.
How's the internet in Letcher County?
Laughable.
People here are laughing, too. Internet's great in Knoxville, right? No? Okay. Often the credit card charges don't go through, though Shepard still has hopes that his move will bring him profit. Now, Chris Green has been listening to all these voices. He studies Appalachia at Berea College in Kentucky. What do you think about when you hear those stories?
All those stories resonate. They're stories of people working to make their lives happen, stories of people who love where they are, and stories figuring out how to stay there as well.
Well, how much practical help are coal counties, or former coal counties in many cases, getting from their government?
Tremendous help, actually. There's something called the Shaping Our Appalachian Region, which was based in between Kentucky's governor and Hal Rogers, the federal head
congressman.
There's also the Promise Zone, which is bringing in over $200 million. This is a zone of six counties that is working with not-for-profits, it's working with private entities, it's working with funders in order to sustain the economic diversity.
Well, why briefly, though, do people feel otherwise? People don't feel like the government's doing anything for them.
I think it's because the government is not overt about it. It's because it's going to the people to make it happen. It's working with the shop owners. It's working with the people who are getting insurance. It's working with the people at the community level. It's not a top-down imposition.
Chris Green, thanks very much. We're going to continue hearing from you throughout this program. We're getting the view from Appalachia. We're before a live audience here at Holly's Gourmet's Market. And the people who are with us, by the way, include a distinguished Knoxville musician, R.B. Morris. Mr. Morris, would you take us out of this segment, please?
In this old world that we got today, who knows how it goes? You may rise, but you may fall. And that's the way it rolls. And him that gets will be him that gets. But what you got will help. They say a rich man, he may lose his soul by saving all that wealth, but it's hell. Hell on a poor boy. It's hell.
We've been listening to a recorded live broadcast by NPR's Steve Inskeep from his trip last month through Appalachia. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear from folks in Knoxville, Tennessee, to talk about healthcare, coal, and culture. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On today's show, we've been taking a road trip with NPR's Steve Inskeep to get the view from these mountains on some political issues. Let's pick back up now with Steve's conversation in Tennessee, where he asks people where they stand on health care issues.
We've met voters, including Nora Connolly, a freshman at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, who had a question for her state's governor.
If I could talk to Governor Haslam, I would say that we need to make sure that there is insurance for every Tennessean who needs it, no matter what income level they're born into, no matter what their level of education is, that everybody should be able to get the health care that they need. My dad is a nurse practitioner who works with low-income groups, and so that's something that I've kind of been brought up to be, like, it's been very important to everybody in my family.
All right, we put Nora's question to Governor Bill Haslam, who's Republican. Now, let's remember, states could opt in or out of parts of Obamacare. Nearby Kentucky embraced the law, especially expanding Medicare for the poor. Tennessee didn't do that, which has left the governor working to find a substitute that does about the same thing.
I worked hard with the administration in Washington to come up with a plan that they would approve. I spent about 18 months on it, and then I thought I could get passed in Tennessee. And so we got the Washington part done, but I couldn't get it passed in Tennessee. Obviously, I still think we'd be better off, or I wouldn't have proposed that. We'll see. To be honest with you, I think so much around health care today is a reaction to the current president.
Because of the name.
I won't say totally that. I mean, if one of our legislators in here, they'd give you some other reasons. But I just think it unfortunately, because it was a part of the Affordable Care Act, it just got very hard for me to drag it across the finish line.
That's Tennessee's Republican Governor Bill Haslam. We're joined now by the mayor of Knoxville, Tennessee, Democrat Madeline Rojero. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's count that as nonpartisan applause. How does it affect your city that Medicaid was not expanded?
Oh, it greatly affects our city. We know there are thousands, tens of thousands of people who are desperately in need of health insurance. And I and other big city mayors across the state pushed to get people signed up, enrolled in Obamacare. And it was so sad at those events, people would come up and they didn't actually qualify for Obamacare, but if we had the Medicaid expansion, then they would get insurance. And to watch their tears and disappointment was just heartbreaking.
Let me ask you about this, though, because as we traveled around the region, we saw evidence to argue both sides of this. We were in Letcher County, Kentucky. It's very poor, and Kentucky expanded Medicaid. Half the county is now on Medicaid, the program for the poor. You can say, well, they obviously need it. It's a poor county. You can also say, wow, that is a huge government obligation. Would you be comfortable if you found that such huge percentages of Tennesseans ended up on Medicaid?
No, I think people need to have benefits from their jobs, number one, and I think more employers need to offer it. So we want people to have the income so they don't qualify. But the reality is there are too many people right now who do qualify, and we need to be offering that to them as a state.
So what is it like to be a Democrat in a red state?
Actually, look at my constituents out here. You know, it's pretty good.
Okay, but Democrats have not done so well for years.
No, but, you know, I think the key to this, being a Democrat in a red state, is not working as a Democratic mayor, but as I am elected in a nonpartisan role. Mm-hmm. And our key to success has been that we're able to reach out. There are Republicans in this room as well.
You bet. You know?
And so we've been able to work with people across party lines and just work on the issues.
Let me ask about one specific issue that's come up in the presidential campaign. I don't think it's resonated across the country, but it's resonated here in this region we're focusing on, Appalachia, parts of 13 states, lots of coal mining, and that industry is dying in many places. Hillary Clinton, presidential candidate you support, made a remark about coal. I want to hear a little bit of that. She said in a speech that she wanted coal miners to find jobs in renewable energy, and then she added this.
We're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business, and we're going to make it clear that we don't want to forget those people.
Okay, it sounds like she was trying to say, I want to help people, but that line, we're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business, hurt a lot of people when we're traveling around who knew that line. Let's bring in Chris Green of Berea College, who's been with us all morning. How does that remark resonate in Appalachia?
It resonates as if people and their heritage and their connections to where they're from aren't respected or known.
Aren't respected or known? Why would that be a matter of heritage? It's business.
Well, these are families who, going back four generations as coal miners, from one father and grandfather to grandson.
Mayor Rojero, do you feel that this is part of the reason that the Democrats have continued for generations now, for several decades, to lose more and more ground in Appalachian states?
Well, I don't think that's the reason. You know, I think the in Knoxville, in the city, so many of us have extended family members who are in the coal industry, and if you're for sustainability and an energy efficiency, a greener environment, we face that struggle, you know, of respecting what our family members and friends and neighbors have done for years, but also recognizing that the world is changing and that we need to change with it and provide people the opportunities they need to be able to seek other employment.
We've got 30 or 40 seconds left. Do you feel you have in your mind a message that your party in this divided country can deliver to redder parts of the country?
Well, what I hope my party will deliver is that in order to achieve any advances, we're going to have to work together. We have to get beyond the party ideology and do like we do at the local level. Regardless of our parties, we're working to solve the problems. And we used to do that at the national level, but we just haven't done that recently, you know, in recent, unfortunately, a decade or two.
Mayor Rojero, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Madeline Rojero, the mayor of Knoxville, Tennessee. We're listening to her. We've also heard from Republican Governor Bill Haslam, many, many voters here. And let's hear just a bit more from Knoxville musician R.B. Morris.
One generation lost to the next. We can't see the future, and we don't look back. We'll be right back.
right. It's time now for a segment on this show we call What's in a Name, where we explore the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. Have you ever heard of a dog serving as mayor of a town? Well, we found one in Kentucky. Is the town named Coonhound or Benji or Rabbit Hash, Kentucky? We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Downcast, and WV Public. You can subscribe and listen, well, on your own time. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So what town in Kentucky elected a dog as its mayor? Rabbit Hash, Kentucky is where a dog named Lucy Lou is now the mayor, which just adds to the unique flair of this Appalachian town, as if the name wasn't quirky enough, right? Rabbit Hash. There's not a whole lot of documented history about the town because floods along the Ohio River have repeatedly destroyed photos and town records. But the town's name is said to have originated during the flood of 1847. At the time, there were lots of rabbits in the area driven to higher ground. The furry animals became a food staple in a special stew called hash. The Rabbit Hash General Store was completely submerged during the 1937 flood, which crested at an unheard of almost 80 feet. For years, the General Store was a gathering place for the community, and local music jams were held there until this past February, when another tragedy struck. The historic General Store burned to the ground, but the owners have built a temporary store next door inside a barn. And they are open 7 days a week. They're determined to rebuild the store. And the community has started a fundraiser to help support the rebuilding efforts. So this week, our producer Roxy Todd made a call to the General Store in Rabbit Hash to see how things are going.
Rabbit Hash General Store.
I was telling your daughter, I remember you used to carry her around, a little pouch around here like it was yesterday.
Well, she won't let me carry her now.
Where's the time go?
And there's another 20.
Thank you.
My name is Terry Marksberry, and I am the proprietor of the General Store. I have been the proprietor for the last 18 years. We have a temporary store set up in the barn, which is at the building adjacent to the old General Store.
Sounds like you guys are doing pretty well. Sounds like there's quite a few people in there right now.
Yes, you know, the sunny weather brings folks out, no doubt about it.
And you all have a mayor that's a dog, right? Lucy Lou?
We do have a mayor that's a dog.
Has she been in there lately?
Is she what?
Has she been around? Have you seen her lately?
She hasn't. I haven't seen her in a while, actually. I don't know. Maybe she's busy because of all of the paperwork and things that need to be done because of the fire. I don't know.
And if people were listening, why should they come visit Rabbit Hash?
It's such a hard thing to explain unless you just come and... It's hard to explain the feeling that you get from this place. You know, it's really... There's just something about this town that just feels old. But, you know, we can't all be wrong. All the people that have come and keep coming, right? Like, we can't all be wrong, so... It's significant. The way that it feels is significant. I don't know how else to say that.
We'll just have to come visit to see.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Special thanks to Terry Marksberry, the owner of the Rabbit Hash General Store, for taking time out of her busy day to share an update. By the way, we hear that these days the mayor of Rabbit Hash, Lucy Lou, has even larger political aspirations. Last fall, she announced that she's running for president of the United States of America. You can find more information about Lucy Lou and the efforts of the Rabbit Hash community to help rebuild their historic General Store on our website, wvpublic.org. If you have another story about Rabbit Hash or know of another place in Appalachia you'd like us to explore, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. Thanks for joining us on our journey this week inside Appalachia. This year, America will elect a new president. Our friends at NPR's Morning Edition are traveling the country to talk with voters to see why we vote the way we do. Host Steve Inskeep took a trip to parts of Appalachia before the primaries to get the view from here. In this next story, Steve travels to the state line in Bristol between Virginia and Tennessee, where he talks with the owner of what some might call the poor man's bank. Let's listen.
We are in Knoxville, Tennessee. We're asking how where you live affects how you vote and how you see the world. Today we have the view from Appalachia, the mountainous stretch from New York to the deep south. We're before a live audience at Holly's Gourmet's Cafe. Folks, will you let the country know you're here? And that may have broken the microphone. We could be done. You know, we came here after a road trip through the mountains, and we began at a distinctive place where we got to do a special thing, stand in the middle of the street in traffic. Anything for the news. Let's listen.
You got to do this once in your life. I'm standing on the center line of a street, State Street, here in Bristol. I got 1 foot in Virginia and 1 foot in Tennessee because the state line runs down the middle of this street.
Bristol straddles the border of Virginia and Tennessee. It's a tourist attraction, home of the Birthplace of Country Music Museum, also the home of Uncle Sam's Loan Office, which is a pawn shop. The owner, Cheryl Brown, described the local economy as she sees it.
My dad always said when the economy was bad, our business was better. But I disagreed with that a little bit, saying, well, if the economy's bad, yes, they come in the store because they need money. But if they don't have the money to shop here, we have to replenish, you know. I sell a ring up there, I loan the money out back here. We're called the poor man's bank.
People bring in jewelry, guns, shiny guitars, also tools and tool belts, the sort of items somebody once used to make a living. They give them as collateral for loans.
It's a sad thing. We see people that are addicted to people that are just lost their jobs. He works 40 hours a week. His wife's home with the baby. His alternator went out. These are the stories we get. And that's why we're here, to help people.
If people fail to pay the interest rates and fees, which total 20% after 1 month, the items go up for sale. We watched a man pawn a knife for $8. Brown only gave him that much because it was made in China. She says the local economy has improved since the financial crisis around 2008, but incomes lag behind the national average.
What concerns do you have more broadly about the country and the direction it's going in right now, if any?
I guess you'll be able to tell who I'm for by what I say.
That's all right.
We need a shakeup.
The pawnbroker favors Donald Trump. He's won Republican primaries in numerous states in the Appalachian region, including New York, just this week. So let's talk about this with Chris Green. He directs Appalachian Studies at Berea College in Kentucky, which is one of the really famous institutions in this region. Good morning.
Good morning.
Obviously, Trump has support across the country, but does his message resonate in a special way in Appalachia?
I think that it resonates in a way that has to do, on the surface perhaps, people might think that these are people who don't feel spoken to. They might feel like President Obama is not doing what he needs to do. But the roots of it go back to the 1980s, mm-hmm. with the beginning of the collapse of the industries in the area, the collapse of the coal economy, which lost over 20,000 jobs in the 1980s, another 20,000 in the 1990s. And what people feel is a loss of their identity and working class power.
Well, that's a good point. Let's follow up on that with a Republican voter who's not for Trump, by the way. His name's Ralph Slaughter. He's a bearded veteran. He's bought guitars and guns at that pawn shop in Bristol, by the way. He said factories and even universities have closed in his area.
We traded in $10, $12, $15 an hour jobs for $7, $8 jobs. And employment, there is none. Go up down any street you want to choose and look at how many houses for sale and how many apartments are for rent. The whole damn place is selling out.
You know, he's concerned about factories closing, and I think there's an opportunity to make a point here that a lot of people might not realize. It's a mountainous region. It's a mostly rural region. But what industries are here?
Oh, there are industries are plastics. There's industry in petrochemical. There's industry in radio. Some of the best radios in the nation are made in Tennessee. The places that we think of as where antifreeze came from, that was developed in Appalachia. Appalachia is filled with industry.
And does all of this mean that questions about trade and free trade resonate here especially?
Tremendously, tremendously. It's another version of the Rust Belt.
We were in a city just the other day that used to have a furniture mill. I guess a lot of them are gone.
They are indeed.
Well, we're digging into the region's problems, but I do not want to forget John Garrett. He is a farmer outside the tiny Appalachian town of Damascus, Virginia, where there was a furniture factory once upon a time. Just listen as Garrett put us in his SUV and started driving overland across a field, around some cows, and up the side of a steep ridge.
Now, this is passable, I promise you. Just hang on. You may wish to close your eyes.
We did not wish to close our eyes because of the view of a mountain valley.
Okay. Now, to me, this is the Appalachian area right here. Mm-hmm. Open land, rolling hills, the mountains, and a little bit of peace and quiet.
And it's about as beautiful as any spot you'd find.
Beautiful country, beautiful.
There's a lot of poverty here, sure, but people feel attached to this place, and Garrett, by the way, has a family burial plot on his land. Some people go to great lengths to move to Appalachia. Garrett's son-in-law, for example, lost his job a little further east as a biologist. Adam Woodson is his name. He and his wife vowed to move to Damascus, Virginia, which was not easy.
We knew where we wanted to live, but there was no way to live down here. I job searched for about 3 years before I was thinking, well, if I'm going to work, I need to work for myself down here because there's nobody that's going to hire me to do anything at a decent wage.
So what did he do? He started the Damascus Brewery, a tiny operation. Its slogan is the best damn beer in Damascus, DAM. We watched him grinding barley on a homemade contraption run by a motor salvaged from a washing machine. He's making it work. He's part of this former mill town now that has remade itself as a tourist stop. It's a destination on the Appalachian Trail. And as we were there, sunburned hikers were walking through town. Maybe they'll buy a beer. Appalachia is a region rich in history that's looking to improvise a future and looking for leaders who can help.
We've been listening to a road trip with Steve Inskeep through parts of Appalachia. Steve went to Tennessee, Kentucky, and Virginia. He didn't make it to West Virginia, but presidential candidate Bernie Sanders made stops throughout the state just last month. He made three stops in one day, starting at a food bank in McDowell County. It's the first time a presidential candidate has visited McDowell since Kennedy in May of 1959. Glennis Board was there for this historic day.
Sanders chose five fishes and two loaves in Kimball, West Virginia, for his campaign stop, a food pantry in the poorest county of West Virginia, one of the poorest counties in the country. The senator began his visit by saying that he wasn't here to rally, but instead to talk about poverty.
Physiology of poverty is the stress that your body deals with every day. When you worry about whether the lights stay on and whether you have enough money to put gas in the car to get to work. And if you can't put gas in the car to get to work, you lose your job. And what happens when you lose your job to the rest of your life? People on the edge every single day. Now, people who have money don't understand what that is about. But when you don't have any money, you're fighting for survival every day, and that takes a huge toll on your health.
Stacks of food were moved aside to make room for over 250 people from around the area who attended the event. It isn't the first time Sanders has been to southern West Virginia. He came 3 years ago to visit with native Sabrina Schrader, who had been to Washington, D.C. to testify before Congress about growing up in impoverished conditions. Schrader, who is now running for House of Delegates, sat on a small stage next to Sanders, along with other panelists, including an attorney, Sam Petzonk, and an elementary school teacher, Tanya Spinella. Topics discussed over the hour-and-a-half visit covered everything from crime, addiction, and healthcare to economics.
You're not going to get a handle on the crime problem unless you get a handle on the drug problem. All right? You're not going to get a handle on the drug problem, I think, unless we deal with some economic issues and we deal with the despair and the hopelessness that a lot of people are feeling.
Sanders called for stories of struggle and solutions from the audience. And when pressed for some of his own solutions, he said people will have to stand together just as they have had to in the past.
That's nothing new. That's the way change in America always takes place. It is the history of the trade union movement. It is the history of the United Coal Miners Workers Union. People stood together and fought back. It's the history of the civil rights movement. It's the history of the women's movement, the history of the gay movement. Whatever movements there are, The only way change takes place, people come together, stand up, and fight back and say that the status quo is not acceptable. And I think that's the moment we're in right now.
Sanders moved on from McDowell to rallies in Charleston and then Morgantown. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Glynis Board in Kimball.
Today on our show, we've traveled to Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, and southern West Virginia. Now, for our final story, we wanted to get a view from up in the northern panhandle of West Virginia from the city of Wheeling. After decades of economic decline, more young people have begun buying and rehabbing old houses in the neighborhood of East Wheeling, historically home to the city's African-American community. The revitalization movement is largely made up of middle-class, white professionals. So how does the movement look to a young person of color from East Wheeling, where nearly 70% of children live below the poverty line? Well, last winter, producer Catherine Moore toured the neighborhood with one of its longtime residents, Ron Scott Jr., who counsels at-risk youth in East Wheeling. We also heard from him on one of our recent episodes talking about the hip-hop scene in Wheeling. But in this next story, he shares his memories of the way things used to be, his perspective on how things have changed, and his opinions about the efforts to re-envision his old stomping ground.
We are in the wonderful snow-covered East Wheeling. Well, this is a little different of a look from when I was younger, but I still love it just the same. My name is Ronald Scott Jr. I am 40 years old. I'm from Wheeling, West Virginia, preferably East Wheeling, and I'm a counselor. There's Jack's, well, what used to be Jack's, the building next to where my Uncle Wiley lived was called Jack's Produce, and it was another hub of the community. It was one of those places everybody went. It was a sustaining neighborhood that people lived in, have memories of, and there's not much of it left. And that's rough. Never really thought about it. And there's, you know, there's new folks coming now. I call them the new Bohemians because they're young, they seem to love life and all about change, they're open-minded. You might see a cat with his headphones in jogging while all his dogs walking around. You might see a white cat with dreadlocks telling you about fruit smoothies and stuff like that. This is stuff that we weren't necessarily seeing back in the day. When you think of Wheeling, I guess in a sense, East Wheeling would be the area that's where the black folks were. The area had a very rich and connected community, and I think a lot of it got lost, mainly because of the drug epidemic and the crimes that came along with it. We had an entire generation that ended up being in prison. We lost an entire generation to that. And then we had an entire generation that was growing up addicted. And then you had a generation that were raised solely by their grandparents. And then when you throw on top of that, the projects that had good intent, like the Hope Six, the projects that tore down the government housing, that Grandview Manor that tore it down, and displaced those families. And like the project that brought this field here that tore down this entire neighborhood and displaced those families, that just fractured and scattered an entire community that was once a lot stronger and a lot more connected. There's a ton of differences between the folks that are from here and the folks that I'm calling the new Bohemians that have kind of made their way here. You got to envy some of the new Bohemians because they see Wheeling as a blank slate. And that's so different than the people that are from here, you know, who remember when this neighborhood was there and now it's gone and they were forced to move over here and now they moved over here. Because what they have, as far as Wheeling is concerned, are the memory of the doors that were shut in their face or the programs that were stopped. But we can learn from their drive, from their incentive, and from their vision. We could definitely learn from that because they're seeing our home in a different way. And the best part is, it's their home now too. So if we could kind of sync both of our visions together, we could do a whole lot of stuff in this area. I think right now in Wheeling, there is a sense of hope that's going along with all the changes and improvements that folks are making around here. But unfortunately, I think it's a lot tougher to see all that hope that everybody else is feeling and momentum when you're poor in the area, especially young and poor. Hope is a luxury that a lot of them aren't afforded. And so as much hope as there is in the city, when you're a young, poor person in this area, it just isn't for you. It's almost like watching a TV show. I, again, like to stay as positive as I can and think that the folks that are here to make change want to include us in the change. Like, they want to change an environment into a better version of itself instead of just what I want it to be and what I see, and it only includes them. So I'm hoping that that is the thing that separates the movement now from gentrification. Like, there's a woman named, everybody calls her Gigi, Miss Gigi, who does amazing things for kids. She does things like, she had a princess party right in front of her house. All these little girls came down, put on dresses, did makeup, nails. One day she had a barbecue. Nobody got charged, everybody ate. She had kickball games, adults versus kids. And what I would need for some of these new bohemian folks to do is get involved with that. You know, don't necessarily try to bring something brand new that could steamroll over something that's already there. You know, Gigi's doing things. See if you can help her, because she would love to help. And it would be great to see folks get behind you. Just take a back seat to us every now and again. I got a lot of hope that I think this is the first wave, and there's going to be more to come. And I think every wave is going to get more and more intense every time until change is all over this area. And we'd be able to sit down with the new folks and the folks that have been here together and talk about the change. Like, I would be able to tell them about Jax and what it was, and they'll be able to tell me about all the things they found out about Jax when they were renovating it and turning it into what it is now. And it'll be a friendly conversation where I'm glad you came and did it, and they're glad that you could tell me this wasn't just a building, you know, that I didn't put all my blood, sweat, and tears into renovating just some wood. Like, this was a place with history, and one hand will wash the other, and it'll be a success.
That piece was produced by Catherine Moore for What's Next West Virginia and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. You can find more stories in this series on our website at wvpublic.org. And there you can also find out how to get involved with the What's Next project in your community. You know, sometimes it's hard to understand why people make the decisions they do. Why they vote for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. Why they choose to get an education or begin a job right away. But does that make their values or life choices any more or less legitimate? You know, that old saying, don't judge me till you walk a mile in my shoes? Sometimes it feels like the national media and the rest of the country judges us Appalachians without coming here to understand us and what our unique struggles are. So I think it is interesting that NPR decided to take this road trip through Appalachia and speak directly with folks right here about their values. I hope it can begin to shed some understanding of our region and our people. Whether it be who we vote for, how we talk, or the clothes we wear, it all matters in understanding who we are and perhaps where we're going as Appalachians and as Americans. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from NPR's Morning Edition. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Ben Townsend, and Kaya Cater. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.